Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C. until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
New from U.S. author Mike Palachuk, Camp America. Here's what American poet David Ray has to say. Mike Palachuk reminds me of Socrates, the gadfly who asks unwelcome questions, Diogenes with his lantern looking in vain for an honest man, Chekhov, the man with the hammer challenging the complacent family to share their meal, Kerouac, the ever on the move, somewhat hysterical searcher, and he also reminds me of many Americans who as children were so blasted with propaganda that they're devoting the rest of their lives to challenging the lies and all who tell them. In this land where babies are brought by storks and buildings collapse due to unpatriotic bricks, we need the gadfly. Because no leader, preacher, guru, or saint will wake us up, though the doomsday clock is ticking close to 12. David Ray, American poet, author of The Endless Search and The Death of Sardanapalus and other poems of the Iraq Wars. To order Camp America and all of Mike Palachuk's books, go to the New American Dream website, www.newamericandream.info. Howard Zinn writes, Mike Palachuk writes with passion, wit, and always with a strong social conscience. Camp America, from author Mike Palachuk. The website again, newamericandream.info.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk, brought to you by the Rock Creek Free Press.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the New American Dream radio show. Today is my wife's birthday. We've had a nice, quiet day. Watched some movies, did little else. It's been fun. This week was the anniversary of the United States dropping an atomic bomb on Japan. Even though they've encountered natural disasters, well, if you can call a tsunami-induced meltdown of nuclear reactors natural, the USA remains the only country to have used an atomic bomb on another country. I'm not proud of that, even though it did very likely save my father's life and thereby make it possible for me to be here talking to you. He was scheduled to participate in the invasion of Japan that ended up not being necessary. Now, there's an abused word. People would have you believe it's necessary to risk lives with unsafe power generation. Necessary to take lives and freedom to keep the world safe for democracy. Necessary to put people in jail to protect them from themselves. Necessary. I think the British use of the necessary is probably most appropriate. It's a room where you go to get rid of your bodily waste. I read recently the Air Force has withdrawn some controversial materials used for training. What were they? Bible passages. Well, the controversial part, aside from that whole, you know, separation of church and state thing, you know, the controversial part was these are used as part of a nuclear training program. They were used to make people feel better about the possibility of nuking somebody. Isn't it great to help people feel good about killing? Isn't that just what you want to teach the world? Isn't that just what you want to teach your children? Oh, by the way, another item in that withdrawn Air Force training manual was a quote from an ex-Nazi SS officer. Real nice assortment of sources there. For several years, I've been using Gmail as an email client because it's so good at detecting spam. Really does has done a great job at getting rid of the things I want to get rid of and keeping the things I want to keep. But recently, they've been putting up an annoying message at the top of newsletters I receive from places like the Citizens for Legitimate Government or Information Clearinghouse. The message, it's something like this. We're letting you see this spammy offering because you told us messages from this anti-government activist were welcome in your inbox. Wouldn't you like to edit your filters and correct this oversight? We're sure you'd be happier if you just get the lamestream news, the lies that are approved by the powers that be. It'd really be a lot better for you, you know, a lot better, Don't you want to make those changes now? Well, the wording might actually have been a little less specific, but feels to me as though the censorship that Google ostensibly refused to permit in China a year or two ago is in force right here, quietly accepted, a little bit hidden. I'm just saying. Well, finally, let me remind you that Mike Palachek's new book, Johnny Moon, should be out probably within the week. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll look for it. And speaking of Mike, I'm going to turn the show over to him now. Let's see what he has to say tonight. Here he is, my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hey, Chuck, how's it going? Tonight we welcome back Lee Herrick. She's from Minneapolis, and Jack Cohen-Jopa from Tucson. So we're coming at you tonight from Vancouver, Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Minneapolis, and Tucson. And I have to tell you, I saw, you know, we moved from Northwest Iowa to Cloquet, Minnesota, and then just recently we moved to Saginaw, Minnesota, which is still Duluth. It's all Duluth. It's just another part of the rural Duluth area. But anyway, I saw my first bear the other day. It was about 6 o'clock. I was driving my car and I saw a black thing go across the road. And of course, to me, I would think it would be Bigfoot, huh? But I thought it was a bear, and I drove up and I looked to my left and there it was. And I think it was a juvenile, but it was still big. I mean, I think if I walked up to it, it would come up to my chest. Anyhow, pretty cool. And today I found a great shore fishing place. So I'm going to try and go back there. It's over on Boulder Lake. And I actually had a fish on the line. I've caught a fish before, but I think this might have been a walleye, but he got off. He had better things to do, I guess. And I'm going to go back there tomorrow morning if I can get up in time. I'd like to read a couple of quick letters here, paraphrase anyway. I got a letter from Mark Kenny. He's doing 6 months at the Duluth Federal Prison Camp, and he's doing 6 months for crossing the line at Offutt Air Force Base, and that's what I went to jail and prison for a long, long time ago. But Mark says, thanks for writing. My stay here goes well. I'm in a six-man room next to the activity room. So between that and the 10 p.m. 3 a.m., 5 a.m. bed counts with flashlights from guards lighting up the room. A good night's sleep is a rarity for me. By the time I get acclimated, I will be out in late October. And he goes on and he talks about, let's see, I said he had met some good people there and also guards probably. But and he said, as for the guards, not much contact again due to economic realities. More prisoners, fewer guards. Most of them see more institutionalized. I'm trying to read Mark's writing. He wrote in all caps. More institutionalized than the prisoners to me, but they faithfully keep the BOP dog and pony show running. I believe some are true believers in the security-driven bureaucratic waste of taxpayers' dollars. God love them. This is my third six-month sentence. I am older. I get crankier. I miss my wife more, Marie, more than I can bear. Sometimes I've tried to be faithful, but life has taken its toll on me. In Christ's peace and Christ's solidarity, Mark Kinney. The second letter I'd like to read is something I've mentioned before, but I wrote a letter to Johnny Carson back in 2001. I was just curious about how he handled the Jim Garrison interview. This is March 2nd, 2001. I found his address in Santa Monica. Mr. Carson, hello. I'm originally from Norfolk, Nebraska, graduated from Norfolk High School in 1973. Recently, I had a chance to listen to the tape of your interview with attorney Jim Garrison. I don't recall watching the live interview, but very well could have, as watching your show before bed was our regular routine, as it was for many others. As a fellow Norfolkan, I am curious as to why you treated Garrison as you did. I will probably not get the chance to contact you twice, so I will be frank right away. You sounded as if you were acting as a spokesman for someone else. Really, were you protecting the real killers of Kennedy? Of course you were. What else can I say? But that is obvious now with almost 40 years of perspective. The Warren Commission was a joke, and Garrison was onto something. Something frightening, to be sure. But why did you have so much allegiance to the plotters and none to your dead president? Because he could not pay you from the grave? Is it as simple as that? Thanks in part to you, we have been forced to live in Disneyland since 1963, where everything is unreal, everything entertainment and illusion. Please tell me, as I will never know myself, is wealth and power worth the sublimation of the truth? Thank you for your time, sincerely. And then Johnny Carson's response came back March 9th, 1 week later. Dear Mr. Polacek, I'm sending you a copy of a letter I recently received to make you aware that some ignorant asshole is sending out letters over your signature. You should look into this. Sincerely, Johnny Carson. And I still mean what I said, but I thought it was so poignant that he got his point across with just three lines. Okay, and I also like to go back again to the two anthrax letters that were sent out way back in 2001. I think they're just so telling. One was, I don't know the date exactly. I think they were sent out in October of that year. This is next. Fake penicillin now. Death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. And then a bit later, they were saying, you cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. And then I'll make my connections a little bit later, but quickly I want to go through another letter, a letter I wrote a while back to our mailing list. It was, the first part of it was called Register Number 11936047. That was my number as a federal prisoner in the 1980s. I had been convicted in the Omaha Federal Court for trespassing off an Air Force base, protesting against the U.S. military. I was in a downtown high-rise federal prison in Chicago, then Terre Haute, then Leavenworth, and a few days in El Reno, and then finished the trip with a long stretch across West Texas to the FCI near El Paso called Latuna. I guess I remember the number because we were made to recite it so often, and I'm really proud to be number 11936047. The next number is 65,500. That's the number of votes I received in the 2000 election. I was the Iowa Democratic Party nominee for the U.S. House 5th District. I ran on an anti-military, anti-prison, pro-immigrant policy. I was shunned by the Democratic Party. I drove a little maroon car all over the huge district, knocking on doors. I lost, but I'm proud of that losing number. I had run as a write-in candidate 2 years before and got 9 votes, so I was proud to get a little more. The next number is 5,000. Once in a while, at tax time, I take a 1040 form and a black magic marker and put a big X through the form and send it to the IRS with a letter saying I will not pay for the U.S. military. but would love to pay for schools, roads, and things that make sense. A couple of years ago, I was fined $5,000 for that action. My wife and I decided to pay the fine. I'm proud of the action, not the paying so much. It's not perfect. It's something. It's a good try. I think a good try is worth something. There's a better way, and maybe I'll find it if I keep searching. The last part of this letter is called Zero, and that's my nickname my high school biology teacher gave me because I often got zero out of whatever on my quizzes. He called me Zero in the hall. He was later my baseball coach. I was the catcher. We won the state championship. We were the underdogs. We tried hard. I didn't feel like a zero then. I don't now. I never told that teacher to go to hell, but I should have. I kept my mouth shut. That's not always a good idea. I don't do that as much now. And this is for all the zeros out there. Keep trying. After I did my big writing campaign for Congress as an unemployed, unpublished writer with a paper route, someone asked me with a smirk how many votes I got, and I said 9. How many did you get? Which is to say that 9 is better than not trying. Keep trying. You might not knock it out of the park, but you might bloop it over the drawn in infield, and that's for sure worth something. If that's what you can do, it's worth your whole life. It's worth everything. And if you are beginning at zero, there's no way but up. And finally, Mark Kenney crossed a line in the sand. Rather a white line painted on cement, challenging big statues and buildings and rank. I'm sure he was afraid. He probably still is. The anthrax letters, well, they were from people within our own government, and they said, remember, are you afraid? Of course we are. We're afraid of everything from death on down to whether this traffic light will change in time for me to keep my job and my life that I have crafted together. And I was afraid when I wrote to Johnny Carson, afraid that I was such a nobody that I shouldn't even be doing this. But I made him think about it for a moment. Let's do what we can while we can. We are not zeros. Nobody is a real zero. And a whole bunch of ones and twos and threes added together can really mean something. We cannot be afraid.
Gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C. until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek.
Make sure to check out Now, starring in the new hit movie, Barack Obama, Special Agent 00 of Change. He flies. He crawls. He speaks. He lies. He saves the people. He does great things. Well, no, he doesn't. Barack Obama, Special Agent 00. In theaters now, or not.
This public service announcement brought to you by the American Spelling Bee Council. How do you spell Al-Qaeda? Could you use that in a sentence? How do you spell Al-Qaeda, the evil ones, towel heads in the caves at the end of the block? Is it A-L-Q-A-D-A, A-L-K-A-Y-D-A, A-L-Q-A-E-D-A, A-L-Q-A-I-D-A, E-L-Q-E-D-A? We spell it CIA every time.
And make sure to watch this Friday night on CBS, Are You Smarter Than a Prison Guard?
I'd like to bring in now our first guest, poet Lee Herrick, is coming to us from Minneapolis. Lee is a poet, a writer, a hand drummer, and recording artist whose collaborations, poems, essays, music, and reviews have appeared in a variety of print and electronic journals. She has a new book. Her first book is coming out soon with Howling Dog Press. You can keep up with Lee on Facebook and at her website, leeherrick.com. Lee, hello. Are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Mike?
Good. I was going to say something about your new book, but I can't really pronounce the name. Can you tell? Could you say
when?
It for me?
Etiolating.
Pardon me?
Etiolating.
What does that mean?
It's when you deprive something of light and it basically turns to white, like, so it, you know, it's a, I'm using it as a metaphor, obviously. You know, if you were to, say, cover something up with a rug in your garden, it would deprive it of light and they would slowly become white.
Okay, cool. Hey, why don't you just take it away?
You don't... I'm not convinced with that remark.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, why don't you take it away and read what you have and tell us about any background you have for the poems that you want to give us. Sound okay?
All right, sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I'm going to start with a section from a three-part poem that is a condom trilogy. That's the title. And this will be coming out next spring from Skid Row Penthouse. I'm just going to read the second section entitled Thinking I Should Have Written Entrenchment Instead. Walking the ditch of nothing, found of nothing there is to find, I find nothing. Then nothingness, then wastelands of proposals, then proposals for counter wastelands proposing further nothingness. Filling the story, filling rhetorical, waxing it dream. A debordic bubble foamed for illusion, hung and clinging to lines, scribing sound, the mouth of its spelling called belief. As not, not moon, not vestibular, not white sliver of cow, a horned curve, a quartered feminine life, through which in this garden of lonesome hours I am entrenched and solemnly pass. I'm going to move on now to three pieces from my Just War CD. This CD was released in 2004, and I thought that I would read from these this work as we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm going to start with a poem titled Defeat of Barbarism. He begged, they searched him and emptied him. He terrified, he begged from the ditch, from the wound, begging, begging as they celebrated, begging, begging, hands up, frozen and afraid, begging as he bled through widespread alliances, as he bled through U.S. backing, as he begged from the ditch of ruin for the terror past, for the terror yet to come, begging and begging the hauled up him. Up they threw him down, removed his pants, and the bursts while he begged of laughter, of shots of emotionless indifference with results. Pulled to his feet from the ditch today, begged for mercy, begged for anything. A man makes allegiances, you know. A man makes alliances and pledges all, even from the ditch, even before he concedes to death, even as he witnesses how it lives in the casting stares of his plundered comrades. A man can change, you know, so he begged for all, even knowing this was war, even knowing how peace was ever held in captivity, yet he rose his hands and begged and surrendered all before the rifle shots and those of the photographer who found him for the New York Times, hands up, frozen in death, looking a little like Bigfoot after the battle at Wounded Knee. This next piece is called Homefront. Moving away from that poem, which was based in Afghanistan, to this one based here in the good old U.S. of A. home front. Though I am late, each snowflake falls onto the skylight, dropping with degrees like the scarcity of language that offers little generosity, but lives within the outdoor rise of breathy whisperings and the best guesses at happy, merry seasonal greetings while we live up to our turtlenecks in Pax Romana, by which I am made more late, it seems, too late to lift from genocide all this land. Too late, it seems, to alter or oppose munitioned securities commissioned for the seas and sands, making me, in fact, so far too late. Too late for Great Lakes, too late for the Gulfs, so tied I am to my own conditioning that I am late for everything. Too late for West Bengal and Bangladesh, too late for the village called Back of Fence. Too late to save next month's Texas execution. Too late to change identities and keep my color-coded political body in the green. I am too late to meet you in language. I am too late to agree how letters relieve or betray during times like these that have always been the repetition of times like then, from which I was born too late, making myself even later than I am, being too late for fame, too late for anonymity, too late for peace and the prisoners of war, too late for men at Guantanamo, too late for soil or even the corn grown next to prodigies, advocated prodigies. I am too late for germline perpetuity or the words that curl like taffy on the tongue of thought that is nevertheless itself too late. Too late for the latest oil spill in Spain. Too late for the Kurds or the Caspian Sea, late by thousands of years and degrees. Too late for all the troubles flown or grown, my lateness, my questionable necessity, held in the prisons of the silencing stands that are themselves always on time, in time that does not sweep the shadows clean, but stays a future stilled within this frame that has borne me out too late for what will come in this old hour in whose time I am too late, though able now to call your name, old enough now to say what I can, though I am still too late for everything, late for even this, my morning song, though it unravels from the lace of my ancient tongue. And this is the last piece I'll read. It's called Page 13 Forward. Who would have thought things could have ever gotten this far? One line following the next as steps in the night follow their path in a particular pattern of sound each witness may have heard, might hear even now a little differently. A sound with a shuffle or a muff, a click or a tap, a hollow sound, an echo perhaps. Whatever it was remains inexact, though the overall effect is still intact. Someone had been walking, perhaps in numbers, maybe alone, or someone has been running here, perhaps alone, maybe in numbers. The sound itself working over years, working as the women worked, working all these years, in a world that kills children, in a world the women prepare them for, cooking eggs, roasting, baking cakes, hoping the suffering still drowning in their tears would one day come to an end, would one day free them from their kitchen vows, where they made so many promises out loud. We will not be trite about this, they wrote in blood. We will say what has happened here.
Thank you very much, Lee.
You're welcome.
Could you tell us once more about your new book and where people can get it and when?
Yes. The book should be coming out in November through Howling Dog Press. The title is Etiolating When, and it's an excerpt from actually that poem that I started out with, the Condom Trilogy. But Howling Dog Press, and they, you can find them online. Howling, I believe it's howlingdogpress.com.
Yep, sounds good. Michael Annis, right?
Michael Annis, yes, and they can also go to my website once it's out. They can either friend me on Facebook and get it through you know, Facebook, or they can get it through me through my website, leeherrick.com.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us tonight, Lee, and have a good night.
Great. I'm happy to do it. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Yep. See you later.
All right.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C., until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
This program brought to you today by your local hometown, just like you, down-to-earth, buddy-buddy military recruiter. Come on, come in and sit down. We know how it is. You need money, something to do with your life, some sort of skill, something to do with your life. Well, hey, without learning how to kill people, you wouldn't know what to do with your life. Dude, we wouldn't either. It's fun to shoot a gun and kill people. When you kill people, you protect America and high school football and Coke commercials and the mall and your grandmother on her porch and pie from
what?
Bakersfield to Bismarck to Birmingham.
I'm on hold.
We could just go get a Coke or something. You like Transformers? Well, we're your local military recruiters. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. For honor, for America, for church and grandma and Coke and pie. And for self-worth and not being bored and a big loser, hey, let's go kill some people. Hoorah! No, not hoo-ha. Watch my lips. Hoorah! There you go. Here's your gun. Shoot that lady, the big one. She's looking at the Dairy Queen cakes. Easy shot. Come on now. She's going to bolt. Her ears are twitching. She senses something. Easy now. Squeeze. Squeeze. Feel the squeeze.
And this message brought to you by the BOP, the Federal Bureau of Prisons. What we have here is a failure to communicate. Think you live in America with a capital M? Think you can do what you want? Think you don't have to pay taxes to pay for weapons that kill people who are opposing United States corporations? Think you would rather have your money pay for schools, roads, poor people, old people? Think again. Look around. Get your mind right. And have a good day. We are the BOP. This program also sponsored by My Spit and My Urine Summertime Lager. It's what assholes drink. Assholes who go out to eat and order a tap from my bar, that is. His mother looks like George Washington. She saves her beautiful mind for beautiful things. She does not care to be bothered with the suffering of others. His father helped to kill the most popular leader his country ever had. He escaped war by lying, but sent others to die. He lied to get into office. He attacked his own country. He now has nowhere to go but back to bed. He doesn't always drink beer, but when he does, he drinks my spit and my urine. Stay thirsty, my friend. And this portion of our program brought to you by Powder Milk Gonads gives Democrats the torpor to do what they've always done in the big yellow dog box. Heavens, they're pasty and felicitous.
Jack and Felice Cohen Joppa have been coordinators of the Nuclear Resistor and co-editors of the newsletter since 1980. The Nuclear Resistor serves to report on arrests for anti-nuclear civil resistance in the United States and, well, other parts of North America, too. They emphasize providing support for the women and men who are jailed for those actions. They serve to network this nonviolent resistance movement and act as a clearinghouse for information. Tonight, I welcome Jack Cohen Joppa to the New American Dream radio show.
Thanks. Thanks to be glad to be with you.
Hello there, Jack.
Howdy.
It's good to have you on the show again.
Thank you.
I've told people a little bit about what you do, but I think I'd like for you to describe the Nuclear Resistor a little bit and tell us about the recent events. People that are in jail now, that sort of thing.
Well, our work began with the realization that in any really significant movement for social change, at least in the United States, people of conscience involved in those movements have ended up in jail, from labor struggles to the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, various civil liberties movements. People end up in jail, and certainly in the movement for a peaceful and nuclear-free future, people engage in civil disobedience and other activity that prompts a reaction from the state. They may be arrested, prosecuted, and jailed. And so our work for 31 years now has been to increase awareness of those people who are in jail among activists in the movement so that we don't forget about the folks in jail, and to encourage others, you know, to support them and know about what they did to get there and why. So that's been the gist of our work. So most recently, our next issue is going to be coming out, our print edition, which is a comprehensive chronicle of all of these anti-nuclear and anti-war arrests across the United States. It'll be coming out around the 1st of September. And so just this past weekend, we saw the 66th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, and then on Tuesday, the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. So around the country, there were vigils, church services, public meetings, and demonstrations to mark these occasions, as well there should be, but of course we don't hear about those events too much in the mainstream media. So just for instance, we'll be reporting on the arrests of six people at the Vandenberg Air Force Base on Hiroshima Day. That's where my wife and I were. And then up the West Coast at the Bangor, Washington Nuclear Submarine Base, four people were arrested blocking the road there on Monday the 8th. At Livermore Lab, the nuclear weapons laboratory east of San Francisco, there were 20 people involved in a civil resistance action on Nagasaki Day. There were five people arrested at the Pentagon that day, another 10 people at the headquarters of Lockheed Martin outside of Philadelphia. So this is a movement that's engaged in these sorts of activities for as long as I've been aware about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki when I first came aware back in the 60s and 70s. And that's the sort of things that we'll be reporting on in the next newsletter.
Well, what you mentioned about
that,
people in jail being, or about not forgetting people in jail, struck a nerve with me. Because people in jail really are prone to be forgotten. Even the conditions they're subjected to inside are horrible.
Yes.
Possibly, yes. Even worse than that is that they become invisible to the rest of us. And that's the real threat. It's almost as if they've been erased.
Right, right. And that's what we're trying to prevent, is that case. And although we support, you know, this particular, you know, class or group of prisoners, we're acutely aware that the indignities and the abuses that they have been suffering in prison are multiplied thousandfold for a lot of other people in prisons and jails in the United States. Torture is legal, for all intents and purposes. It's the de facto reality of life in a lot of American prisons, from solitary confinement to forced extractions from cells. These things happen to a lot of people. And often, you know, the middle class, sometimes often middle class, often white nuclear and anti-war resistors in prison in the United States, you know, they may get preferential treatment or seem to, but sometimes not. One case that I'd like to talk about and make note of particularly is that of a friend of ours, Sister Jackie Hudson, who passed away a week ago yesterday in the intensive care unit at a hospital near her home in Washington State. Sister Jackie Hudson has been involved in anti-nuclear activity and speaking truth to power for a few decades, and most recently was in prison in Georgia following her conviction along with a dozen other people for trespass a year ago on July 5th at the Oak Ridge Y-12 nuclear weapons complex in Tennessee. They were tried and convicted for trespass, and Jackie and several of the other defendants decided that they would not cooperate any longer with the state, and they refused to promise to return to federal court for sentencing. So in May, they were taken into custody. And there are currently six of those defendants in prison. There had been two other women. Jean Gump was released because of health concerns, and also Sister Jackie Hudson. When she was in a private prison in Ocilla, Georgia, at the end of May, she began to experience severe chest pains. And they, after a lot of intervention from other prisoners, she was finally given, you know, just over-the-counter pain relief medication and taken to an observation cell, which in these prison contexts usually means solitary confinement, and someone kind of peeks in to see if you're still breathing. And that's about the only care and attention that she received throughout the entire Memorial Day weekend. Other prisoners were very concerned. They were aware that she barely had the strength to feed herself over that long weekend. And it took the final intervention of federal marshals to get some attention to the situation. Jackie was willing to promise to return to court if she could be released now to receive proper health care that she was being denied while in the jail here in Georgia. And that it took another 6 or 7 days before she was finally transferred to Knoxville the day before she was going to appear before the judge and sign the papers. Well, when the federal marshals delivered her from the Georgia jail to the Knoxville City Jail and they did a preliminary evaluation upon intake, the nurse at the Knoxville jail immediately sent Jackie to the hospital. And there is where she had to have the paper, where she signed the paper, and it was taken before the judge with an affidavit that she was in the hospital and she was released. And sadly, she had contracted myeloma, a leukemia-type disease, and she regained enough strength to travel back home to Washington, but then was hospitalized again and passed away a week ago today. So I would like to honor Sister Jackie Hudson as a nuclear resistor who's paid the ultimate price from medical neglect in prison, adding to her other health concerns. So still in that jail in Georgia, we have Michael Wally, Steve Baggerly, Sister Carol Gilbert, Sister Ardith Platt, Bonnie Erfer, and Sister Mary Dennis Lynch. And they're all awaiting sentencing sometime in September, different dates in federal court. And I can go through names of other people who are also currently in prison for civil resistance activities against the nuclear weapons complex.
I think after a point, the names aren't as important as the situation. The fact is, there are many, many people, perhaps you have a number, in jail for protesting, for standing up for what they believed was right. And our hearts go out to them, and our prayers will too.
Well, and the good news is that the longest held nuclear resistor in history,
that would be Helen Woodson.
That would be Helen Woodson, is due to be released on September 9th. And she intends to retire from nuclear resistance. What's that?
We're looking forward to having her out.
Well, we are too. And hundreds of people have come forward to help contribute to a little bit of a kitty to help her get established once she gets out. She's going to be for 8 years on parole from her previous convictions, and she will be forbidden from having contact with people who are involved in this movement these days, particularly those who have been arrested or convicted of felonies, which includes a lot of her colleagues. But she is confirmed as a lay Benedictine oblate and has that religious vocation to follow as she resumes her life on the outside. She will certainly be praying for peace while others continue other actions.
Well, Jack, we're about out of time. I thank you so much for sharing some time with us, and especially that story that really, really moved me.
Yeah, we really want to emphasize that, you know, we imprison way too many people in this country. There have to be alternatives to incarceration. It'll be cheaper, and it'll preserve communities better, and it'll really solve the problem of criminal behavior if we really make an effort not to just lock people away, forget about them, and pretend that they'll be social when we eventually let them out.
Right.
And I want to encourage people to visit our blog at nukeresistor.org. They can sign up for a monthly email bulletin there and information on subscribing to the comprehensive print newsletter. Nukeresistor.org.
Well, thank you for announcing that, because that was the next thing I was going to ask you. Jack, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of months.
All right, thanks. Take care.
You too.
Jews and UFOs, the new hit movie now showing in every mall and on every small street corner in America. If you were the first one ever on Earth to see a UFO, would you call it God and burn myrrh and frankincense and shit all night long from here till Tuesday? If you saw a UFO take off straight up, would you get everybody back here next Sunday and show them what you saw? See, it was right there. If you talked to an alien on a mountain, would you write down everything he said and take it back to Grandma and Uncle Irving and tell them that they better do this shit or else? You would. You would do that and more. Dominus vobiscum, ecum spiritu tuo. Jews and UFOs, the crap that made the Bible famous. Matinees half price, no gift coupons, please.
It must be nightly news time in the neighborhood. There goes Dick and Spot out the front door. Dick runs fast. Look at his little legs go. Spot runs fast as well. They're on the same page. They do not trust Brian Williams and Katie Couric and Matt Lauer and Jim Lehrer and Barack Obama. Dick and Spot both know from extensive experience that they will not tell the truth. They do not tell the truth about, well, anything. They're court jesters. There's no truth in Pravda or the Today Show or the Nightly News. This much we know. Good Spot. Spot stopped running. Spot stopped to roll around. Dick is still running. There goes Jane, too. Jane is fast.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. It's been kind of hot, and the river was high because of the rain, and there were bugs to beat the band at the county fair, and lots of people just stayed in their cars with the AC running until it was time to come out for 15 minutes to see their grandkids in the sheep judging or the lemon cake finals or the tug of war that finally ended the whole thing. There have also been more burials at sea. Jim, that one guy from Jiffy Lube, buried at sea. And Seamus, the guy who was a priest, but now he was the fly fishing expert at Bob's Bait and Takeout, buried at sea. And the summer intern at the Wednesday Miracle, she's named Mary Marble from Kearney State College. Well, she's only 18, but she's a history buff. Her parents are professors from some Twin Cities suburb, and they've been to Toronto, I guess. Big deal. Well, Mary is trying to fight the revolution, it seems. Good luck with that, her editor told her. But still, he let her talk about the war, even in a weekly newspaper. She had this historical novel she wrote. It was already on her computer in Courier 12 point with the right margins and headers and footers and everything. And he suggested she run it as a column through the summer. And though they both knew they could not talk about Iraq and Afghanistan without calling the troops saints, maybe the readers would understand that they were talking about today by talking about the invasion of Panama about 100 years ago, way, way back in the 1980s or something. Mary Marble loved the idea. Her first column installment ran this past week, and by all accounts, she's still in town. Some say her car is even parked on the street.
On a warm Wednesday night in December 1989, Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Mahoney sat on the bench in the officers' gym at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. His team was ahead by 10 in the middle of the last quarter. He leaned back on the bench with a towel over his head, recalling the shot from the left corner. Both gym doors were propped open with cement blocks to let the night air blow through. Mahoney put the towel up over his head, off his face, so he could suck in the male smell of the gym. He farted and inhaled, looked at the south door, saw a few Salvadoran soldiers hanging around, staring in. "Too dark for handball," Mahoney nodded toward the door. "I thought the new bug zappers were supposed to keep the beaners entertained." "Hey, Jonesy, that's a good foul." "They just want to kick the ball around," said the other officer. "Don't know how to use their hands." Mahoney made a jerking off motion with his right hand above his crotch. As time ran out on the game, the men began to move toward the locker, taking random long-range shots. "Rrr! Rrr!" Over the speakers around the base came a foghorn sound, short, insistent, like a fire truck demanding to get through city traffic. The men sprinted to the locker room, leaving basketballs scattered around the gym floor. The Salvadorans moved slowly into the gym, laughing softly. "They left lights on," one said in Spanish. They began to spread out and pass the basketballs back and forth with their feet.
As the alarm sounded at Fort Bragg and the bombers scattered at Fort Stewart in Savannah, Georgia, and the helicopter pilots aboard the carrier parked in the Gulf of Mexico hurried to the briefing room with hands full of Snicker bars, barbecue Fritos, and Coke cans, a young woman in Panama City scolded her children with a smile. "Get in the house now, mijos. Andale." She looked in the sky to see the flashes and beams of light. She clutched her chest and jerked around at the crack as her youngest son kicked a flat soccer ball perfectly into a garbage can on his way into the house. Paulo turned to her with his hands forming goalposts in the air and beamed. She rubbed his raven head and held the door open. She turned to watch a military jeep screaming down the littered, dirty street. General Noriega had made yet another speech that day, but they had no radio. Her husband had been told to report for duty that afternoon on his day off. Inside the trailer, the five children ran down the narrow hall to the bedroom, stripped off T-shirts and jeans, and raced to the bathroom. Maria Cordova scolded them to be careful with the high water. "Don't burn yourselves. Don't splash. Hey, you can't all fit in there." She brought cherry Kool-Aid and Pop-Tarts into the bathroom for the three as they sat naked on the backless bench, waiting their turn. Their tangled feet played with each other like monkey tails. She knelt by the side, washing the back of three-year-old Juanita. She sang to her, "De Colores," as she heard the helicopters whap, whap, whapping over the trailer parts. "De Colores se visten los campos en la primavera." The little one stopped her struggling and looked up at her mother, noticing the face for the first time in her life. Juanita saw the smiling brown eyes and the swaying cascade of black hair around the pretty, perfect face. Her mother's teeth were white as milk flakes and her lips full and generous, red as ripe coffee berries. Maria scooped up Nita and swaddled her in a thin pink towel, pushing her off down the hall. Maria turned to walk into the kitchen. She stopped by the small hall window. She pushed back the yellow flower curtain with a red fingernail and bent down to see into the street. Men in uniform stood in the back of a military jeep, clinging to the roll bar, searching the night sky. One shot his automatic weapon into the air, and Maria saw the flash of the gun. Then the camouflage Ford roared off down the street, disappearing into the blackness.
In Washington, George Bush sat behind his mahogany desk in the Oval Office. He spoke on the phone to General Colin Powell, who stalked the war room on Sherman Hall in the north wing of the Pentagon. Bush wore a gray cardigan sweater over a white polo shirt. He listened intently and pulled on his right ear. When he spoke, his lips came to a dull point. Yes, yes. With Powell was National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft. Scowcroft scrunched in a high-backed, deep-cushioned chair and appeared sound asleep. Powell stood and studied a detailed street map of Panama City. He and Bush had long ago decided to attack Panama in order to capture General Manuel Noriega. Powell told Bush the CIA knew of half a dozen locations where Noriega might be found, including the Fantigo Trailer Park on West Calle de Santiago, where Noriega was said to keep a shack house for personal concubines. "Well, you do what you need to do," said Bush. "The American people are behind you. We salute you. We support the troops. I'm behind you. Barbara is behind you. We prayed for you and your men this evening. Vaya con Dios. May God go with you. Thank you, Mr. President." The general hung up the special mauve phone and strode from the room in battle fatigues, toothpick in his mouth. Scowcroft remained hunched in his chair, leaning on his arm.
Lieutenant Ryan Mahoney stood with his hand on the balance beam, night paint covering his face, his helmet tightened under his chin. The fire in his eyes meant life, something happening. He saw the two rows of seated paratroopers silently anticipating the jump into downtown Panama City. They seemed frozen as if their arms and legs would never move again, gone dead. But Mahoney had never felt so alive, so useful. Each brain cell and nerve in his body was on full alert, living in the moment, enjoying the day, centered, thriving on the zen energy generated by the tingle of the hum of the engine through the skin of the airplane. Mahoney again mentally checked his M16, three grenades, knife, and city map in the metal tube on his side. His unit would set down on the edge of the downtown area and come in from behind the trailer park where Noriega might be, blocking any bashful departure by him or his troops upon the arrival of the unexpected company. Noriega had known for hours the Americans were coming by monitoring the communications of the United States military compartments and no word the past 3 days from the White House or his CIA contacts. He had known and gone into hiding, leaving his undermanned troops to scan the skies with weak flashlights to highlight the bombs as they descended.
In Lincoln, Nebraska, in the Havelock neighborhood, a retired gentleman sat on his couch. His wife was just returning with the popcorn as the news came on. Special report. She turned out the lamp to make it cozy, as her husband liked it. She sat down, and he got up and returned with two red and white Budweiser cans, popped both and gave one to her as he got comfortable. The screen was filled with the face of Dan Rather, saying that a United States invasion of Panama was in progress. Rather told about planes taking off from Fort Bragg and Fort Stewart, and that a fleet of destroyers and an aircraft carrier were in position for the assault of Panama City. "The 82nd Airborne Division is right this moment dropping into the city," Rather said. The man reached for his popcorn, keeping his eyes glued to Rather. The woman sipped her beer. She noticed a car door slam outside. She wanted to peek out the blind, but he liked her to stay put once they cozied in for the news, not bouncing up and down like some GD jack-in-the-box.
Maria Cordova went to the door to answer the banging. Her sister, who lived in a trailer down the lane, was excited and crying. She said the Americans were coming. She said she and her husband were heading to the community hall. She said they were coming to kill Panamanians. Maria comforted her sister. She told her to go to the hall if she wanted, but reminded her with a smile that it was a fair distance from here and dark. Maria said she would be getting her children ready for bed. She would listen even though the military base was on the far side of the city and General Noriega had men out patrolling. She had seen him just a while ago, Maria said. It has nothing to do with us, she said. Maria's sister left. Maria watched her hurry in bare feet and disappear in the night. Maria went back into the trailer and could not find her children. Come out, wherever you are, she sang out. She stood quiet in the hall, her hands on her hips. She knew the little one would give the others away. Soon Maria heard faint giggling. She tiptoed to follow the noise, then bent over and crept into her own bedroom where she found five sets of eyes like a row of raccoons under her bed. She did not laugh or scold them. She got onto her stomach, stretched out her arms, and pulled them close to her. Mijo, she said, do not be afraid. And then she led them in a rapid Hail Mary, Our Father, and Glory Be.
She said the Blessed Virgin would watch over them and reminded them that their father was out with the army making sure nothing bad happens in the night. You will wake up tomorrow, and whatever is bad out there will be gone. We'll play soccer and have a tortilla, you kiss in the air picnic. That's what Conchita was saying, that we should have a picnic tomorrow. No, Mama, said Paolo. She said the Americans are coming with guns to hurt us. We need to hide. You get under here. There's room. He tried to make his little voice deep. Maria brushed the black hair from his brow and pinched her lips together. Stay here, she commanded the raccoons under the bed. She hurried down the hall, peeking quickly out the window, then moved to the door. She unhooked the latch and pushed it open a crack. She looked into the sky and saw it ablaze with exploding fireworks and arcing lights, like a farmer with a flashlight trying to find his glasses in the dark. The military jeep was back in the street with men in the back firing their weapons into the sky. Maria looked up, and in the patched light she saw that the sky was filled with bits of dry dandelion, blown by the breath of God, floating ponderously toward the guns. The men in the rear of the jeep cursed the driver. The driver shoved the vehicle into reverse, rammed into a tree, pulled ahead, careened on two wheels down the street. The dandelion bits meandered down, down. Maria gasped to see the black whale swimming above in the inky ocean, with fireflies blinking around its wings and tail. As the white parachutes floated down around her, Maria flinched at the sounds of their weapons, tinging the sides of the trailer houses. She ducked back inside, slammed the door, rushed down the hall, then turned back to close the door again. When she reached the bedroom, the back wall was in flames. Maria flung herself to the floor, reached under the bed, and began pulling out hands and arms. Stay together. Hold on to each other. Is this happening to me, she thought. Am I a grown woman under the attack of men dropping from the sky, trying to save my children by myself? I can't do this. I'm too small. She told herself to move more slowly, to make her motions controlled when she saw the terror in each of the faces as she hauled them out from under the bed. One more set of raccoon eyes underneath, and the smoke in the room told her to send the children into the kitchen. I'm staying, said Paolo. You go ahead. I'll be all right. Papa's out there. I'm in here. You're covered. Take care of the children. Your child, too, she cried. Come, you help me with the others. Paolo accepted her hand, and they ran together down the hall that pushed as narrow as an enclosed, slippery slide. Maria went to one knee in the kitchen and gathered the children in her arms as her bedroom became engulfed in the firestorm. We're going outside, she said. The bad men are out there, one said. The fire is in here. She crouched and looked them each in the eye, her back growing warm from the blaze. They coughed. They dug at their eyes with toy doll fists, Juanita unlocked the door and opened it a crack to let their cat outside. Your father's out there, too, assured Maria, and I will be with you. We will keep you safe. She stood in front of them, one arm behind her, encircling them all, one hand on the doorknob. Something popped, then exploded in the hallway. She hopped out to the metal porch and reached in and helped each of them over the gap between the first step and the trailer door. She heard the cries of her neighbors and the shouts of the men from the air.
Flamethrowers were burning the trailer homes as the white parachutes continued to fall like large snowflakes. The green jeeps in the street were now filled with Americans. Music by Guns N' Roses blared in the background. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Mahoney had not landed in the downtown area, but directly over the Fantico trailer park. Surrounding the trailers, the neighborhood was street after street of junky, dangerous barrio. As he was landing with his weapon spraying the ground below him, he was checking his map. When he hit the dirt street in front of Maria Cordova's home, he had already decided that the whole area must be secured. He ordered his men to fan out, close the perimeter, and consider anything that moved to be hostile. As Maria Cordova crouched with her arms around five children, came moving toward Mahoney in the alternating darkness, she appeared to him like a pair of soldiers advancing. Maria shuttled her kids this way, then the other, like a mother goose looking for a way out of the lights of a car. Mahoney snapped his M16 to his shoulder and fired in one expert motion. His bullet, made by a single mother temp worker for Alliant Systems in Hopkins, Minnesota, smashed Maria in the forehead. The force of the little missile knocked her off her feet. She floated for a long while, feet outstretched, arms swimming. She saw the stars winking and she beamed. Nothing more to do, everything done. Chores and duties completed, she rested at last. She landed on her back, arms stretched outward and across, her legs curled in a figure four. The children, covered by spots of their mother's blood, scurried and fell around her. Juanita cried. Paula picked up his little sister and sang to her De Colores. While the men with blackened faces ran all around them, the children of Maria Cordova held her dead hands and recited a frightened Hail Mary while Paula continued to sing. Y por eso los grandes amores de mucho colores me gustan a mí. Paula cried while he sang harmony to the prayer. He licked the salt tears and tried to wipe the blood from Juanita's forehead, only smearing it. Mahoney ran forward a few steps, then leaned into the scene to make out the children. He put his hand into the air to stop the firing, but the action was on automatic. His men could not see him, only the fire of fear, fed by a wild rage to live.
Mahoney crept ahead slowly in a crouch, his weapon on his hip, as tracer bullets from both sides slammed into the Cordova children huddled over their mother. A single bullet from a South Dakota teenager efficiently pierced the skulls of Paolo and Juanita. The soldier turned to his friend, his mouth open, an excited, surprised smile covering his face as if he just killed his first pheasant. The largest chunk of Paolo's forehead landed on his mother's chest, while a spray from two boys from the same high school in Casson, Minnesota, keeping together for safety, splayed the other three children onto their front yard of weeds and broken glass. The Minnesotans ran to their kill, pointed their weapons into the air, and shot out the stars, whooping, counting coup. The retired couple in Lincoln, Nebraska, now had the popcorn bowl situated between them. They brushed hands while reaching at the same time, turned to each other, and almost smiled. When the Mozart NBC invasion theme music played, they tried to muffle their chewing. The title Just Cause filled the screen, while a United States helicopter flew over the downtown of Panama City as Dan Rather told viewers that rebel Panamanian General Antonio Noriega was on the helicopter headed for United States Federal Prison in Miami. Likely, sources say, said Rather, to be tried for drug trafficking. In the morning, the couple from Lincoln rose early to drive downtown for breakfast. They held hands across the seat. The man stopped at the Lincoln Star Journal box outside the restaurant in FedEx Corners As they sipped coffee, he read about the invasion. His wife read the joke of the day, birthday announcements on the morning news sheet from the radio station. General Colin Powell walked down Maria Cordova's street and from a distance saw persnickety crows picking at the bodies of Maria and her five children. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Mahoney walked with him, still in battle dress, without helmet. Neither had slept. Mahoney accepted a black cigar from Powell. The weapon he carried loosely was empty, his face smeared and sweaty. The trailer park was gone, as was the neighborhood around it, up to a 10-square-block area. "We secured this area in about an hour and a half," Mahoney said. The two puffed together. Powell and Mahoney scanned in unison to the left, to the right. As military vehicles hurried back and forth behind them, they continued their walk. And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the summer help bounty hunters, ski instructors, are about average. Thank you for joining us tonight, and each week, we hope you'll continue to do so. Hope you'll stay tuned for Black Op Radio immediately following, a little more immediately than usual. We went a little over time here. Thanks again to Rock Creek Free Press for sponsoring our show, and come back again next week. Good night.
Gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C., until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek.